Welcome to Ordinarily Extraordinary Conversations with Women in STEM. I'm your host, Kathy Nelson, an electrical engineer who loves to hear and share stories of other women in STEM. This week's guest is Dr. Mary Kinsella. She's a women engineers career strategist and the founder and CEO of Her Engineering Career, a company which helps women engineers strategically navigate their career. She does this by helping them improve technical competence, credibility, and expertise, finding and maintaining a career trajectory, expanding decision-making and leadership skills, attaining visibility and recognition locally and in the engineering community, amongst many other factors. She is the host of the podcast by the same name, Her Engineering Career. Prior to founding her company, Dr. Mary Kinsella spent over 30 years working at the Air Force Research Laboratories as a civilian in engineering and scientific research. She has a PhD in industrial and systems engineering and a master's degree in materials engineering. I really had such a great conversation with Mary. And if you've listened to my podcast before, you know that I always end by asking for advice. In this conversation, I really felt like Mary offered advice that I really needed to follow. And it really, really spoke to me. But you'll have to wait till the end of the podcast for that. I hope you enjoy her story. Hi, Mary. How are you?
Hi, Kathy. I'm well. How are you?
Good. I am so excited to talk to you because you have headphones and a microphone and you sound so great.
I'm in my closet.
Nice. All right. So I am really excited to talk to you. I think let's just get into what you do in the company that you started and what you're currently doing for a job.
Well, this is my, what I call my encore career. And I'm a career strategist for women engineers. And my business is called Her Engineering Career. And I help women engineers confidently command greater influence and impact. And I do that through coaching and writing and consulting. I also have a podcast, Her Engineering Career Podcast. And this is something that I wanted to do following my own engineering career because I have experience in this area. And it's not easy being a woman engineer because we're still very much in the minority. And even if you compare today to when I started, there still are issues that women face every day. And so I think through my own experience and what I went through in my career, I can help other women, you know, get the most out of their careers and help them through some of the struggles and make it easier on them.
So the women that you work with that come to you for help, is there some common themes that you see on challenges that they have?
Yeah, I would say the number one challenge is competence. Mm-hmm. And it almost doesn't matter where you are in your career, whether you're just out of college getting started, or if you're getting close to retirement. It seems like confidence is a big issue for many women engineers. So that's a lot of what I do, help them with courage and confidence and learning how to take more risk and build your risk tolerance and things like that. A couple of the other things that I help them with are visibility and recognition, help them learn how to speak up for themselves and how to talk about what they do and what their impact is to the right people. So that helps them with that visibility and recognition and also helps them to be considered for opportunities.
I want to dig into a couple of those things. And then there's so many things I want to talk to you about. So confidence. So this is like, I don't know if it's a pet peeve of mine. It's definitely a challenge that I also have. And I find it fluctuating, you know, like I was very confident. And then I now work as a consultant and I had kind of an experience where I had some work that wasn't necessarily received well, and which I very much internalized. And then became like, I totally found my confidence dropping, which I thought was really interesting because I didn't necessarily think that I had that issue before. And then I'm like, I don't like having like one thing that can affect my confidence that greatly. And it kind of surprised me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I read a book. I can't think of the name of the book right now, but I was attending a Women in Leadership Summit, and one of the breakout sessions was on confidence. And it was, you know, talking about how girls' confidence starts plummeting in kind of like around middle school. And kind of about this, a couple years after this, my middle daughter was taking her driver's ed classes. And I have a son that was like 12 at the time. My 12-year-old son would tell my daughter how to drive. And I'm like, well, this is interesting, right? So I'm like, my son is becoming this like know-it-all because he knows how to drive at 12, right? And then, I'm also reading about how girls' confidence is plummeting. And I'm like watching this in like real time going like, why is this? Like, I find it really fascinating. Do you have any insight into like why that happens? Especially that particular time. And I know that's probably more of like a psychologist question.
But. Right. Yeah. So I don't have all those answers, but that's been pretty well known for a while that, middle school is when you see the confidence in girls go down. And it's partly, the culture, how we were raised and what we were told that girls can do and girls can't do. And it's partly what do I want to say? It's not cool to be smart when you're that age as a girl. There's still the underlying stories that say, you should look good and sound good and be happy-go-lucky, but smart isn't really high up on the list. And so that's I know is one of the reasons why this occurs at that age. And then there's just a lot of messages that you get from society and from what you see in the media and what you hear from your family that tell you how you should be as a girl. And that also has an impact. All of those things play a part when you get to having a job, right? But there's also things that come into play like imposter syndrome. It's not just women that have imposter syndrome, but mm-hmm. women get that a lot. And, it's just feelings of, I don't belong. I don't really know what I'm doing. And those kinds of ideas, I think, get amplified in engineering because you are in the minority. You don't have a lot of role models. And there aren't a lot of women to interact with and build your confidence with. So those are some of the obstacles you have to overcome.
Yeah. And I think, when you talk about like being alone and not having anyone to talk through things with, from a standpoint of the imposter syndrome, one of the things that, and I didn't necessarily set out to do this with the podcast, but having community, whether they're at your company, whether they're on the other side of the globe, is so important because we all go through the same thing. And I think just to have just to be able to have somebody else say, oh, me too, like I totally mm-hmm. feel that way too. It's so beneficial. Mm-hmm. And, I don't know about you, but I was for a number of years, the only female engineer at my company. And I didn't have anyone to, I had people outside of my company, which is fine too, but other women engineers, but not a large pool of people to talk through things with. And I think that that's having that community. It feels like one of the most important things that there is, so mm-hmm. that you don't feel alone, and especially to like stay in engineering. So there's the whole thing of like, getting women to go into engineering. And then there's the whole thing of keeping them there so that they aren't leaving because right. they're miserable.
Right. Right.
I do want to ask, what kind of tools and skills do you help the women that you coach from a confidence standpoint? Because like I said, this is something that I have struggled with periodically throughout my career, mm-hmm. depending on, like I said, I kind of plummeted weirdly last year and then trying to build it back. It plummets a lot faster than it builds back up. So I'm yeah. working on building that back up, but what kind of tools and skill sets do you use to help the women that you're coaching?
Well, let me first go back to your comment about community. That's so true. One of the things that women can do is to try to find support from some kind of support group. For example, when I started working at the lab, I was in a position like you where there weren't any other women engineers in my branch, and I felt very isolated. And that was the time that I joined the Society of Women Engineers. And that was the main reason why I did so that I could go to these meetings and talk to other women who are in similar situations and get ideas from them and you know, just talk to them about how you feel about it and what you should do about it. And then the other idea for community is one that's in some areas has kind of taken off recently, and that is employee resource groups. That was another thing that I started at the lab a couple of years before I retired from there. And that was to get a group of going for women so that they could just, if nothing else, just get together and share stories and lessons learned and help mentor each other and that sort of thing. But that group has grown. It's called AFWISE, Air Force Women in Science and Engineering. So now that they have opportunity to have not only social events, but mentoring events, both formal and informal. They've done a couple of seminars for women, talking about the issues that they have in the lab. And they've brought in speakers, and it's just been very beneficial for them because there's so few and far between. When I started the group, I think there were 16% women engineers and scientists at the lab. And so, you know, you're so far between, you don't see each other to talk to during the day. So if you have one of these groups where you can intentionally come together, it's very helpful. The other thing I try to get my clients to do is, in a way, put themselves out there. So if you can be courageous and take on more activity that in your mind is more risky, and that so that you can build your confidence and build your resilience, be conscious of the kinds of things you're doing, the activities that you're doing, and don't be afraid to take on challenges. It builds your resilience. And by doing those activities and experiencing the good and the bad of those activities, you build your confidence. Confidence just doesn't automatically happen. You have to use your courage and do things to build it. So those are the kinds of things I try to work with my clients.
Do you find, and so I mentioned like the issue that I went through like a year ago. Do you find that women internalize things more? So like if there is a criticism or something doesn't necessarily go perfectly, they internalize it as like, oh, I'm awful, this is me, versus like, this is, I actually talked to my therapist about this because I was like trying to, you know, navigate this because it flummoxed me so much for like quite a while. Like I was kind of obsessing about it. And she's like, you don't know what that person is going through. And so you are putting their reaction to what you did. And as long as you do a good job of what you do, you can't internalize their reaction to something. And I thought that was really interesting because I internalize everything. Like I internalize and I obsess. It's awful. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And do you find that women, and I'm assuming you're coaching mostly women, so I don't know that you can answer this question, but do you find, or do you think that women do that more often than men do?
In my experience, yes. Men have an easier time of letting things roll off. Mm-hmm. And women tend to, well, I think they just get really engaged in what they do and they put their all into it. And so it becomes part of them. And yes, they tend to internalize things. So that's a generalization. Some women do it more than others. And I also think that as you move in through your career, you learn how not to do that as much. But if you're comparing men to women, I would say, yeah, definitely women tend to do that more.
Well, and I think, you know, like the more you get into leadership, the higher visibility that you have in your role, you have to let things roll off or you would be, I think, completely miserable. So I think that that's probably something you have to learn as you move into leadership. I apparently have not learned that very well. I'm working on it.
Okay. Yeah.
It's definitely a work in progress for me.
Yeah, that's definitely true. As you get into, especially the higher levels of leadership, you have to have that resilience. You have to be able to let things bounce off of you a little easier.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to talk about your podcast. So I listened to an episode of your podcast and the one that I listened to was you talking? Is that how most of them are? Do you have guests on, or is it typically like you having kind of like these little kind of like, I don't know, mini skill set training sessions, or kind mm-hmm. of like, what's your format of your podcast?
Yeah, that's my format right now. I have not started to interview others as of yet. So my podcast has been out there since about June. And so this is the format I have taken on thus far. And it's pretty much that, as I pick a topic and try to focus on some tips or tricks or guidance that I can leave with the listener that they can take with them.
Well, and I like it because it's, they're pretty short, what, like 15, 20-ish minutes, something like that. So they're nice, like bite-sized chunks, mm-hmm. something that I think you can, you know, pick up and, you know, listen to and have like a takeaway from that you can immediately apply, which I think is great. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I have a question for you though. So how do you find talking to a microphone without somebody else on the end? Cause I will say I struggle, and my listeners may understand this, because my intros, when I am doing my intros, which are maybe a minute long, and I'm just talking to a microphone, I have a much, much harder time with that 1 minute than the entire rest of my podcast where I get to talk to somebody. So how do you find talking to a microphone with no one on the other side of it?
My problem is different in that I write out what I want to say, and it's usually pretty structured, and I don't do a lot off the cuff. So my challenge is making it sound conversational, or not like I'm just reading it.
I think you do a good job, by the way, because I could not tell that you were reading it. I also write mine and read it, and I still struggle with it.
But it does, you know, they tell you to pretend there's someone there on the other side of the microphone and talk to them.
I'm not very good at that.
Yeah, I find that a little bit harder. I think it does help.
How do you like podcasting?
Well, I tell you, I like it a lot more than I thought I would. You know, I started with a blog more than a year ago, maybe even 2 years ago now. And, you know, I was doing fine with that. And as I was revamping my her engineering career business, my coach then said, you know, you should really start thinking about a podcast, because lots more people listen to podcasts than read blogs anymore. You know, at first I thought that was unbelievable, because, you know, I was a person that tended to read blogs more, but I didn't say no. And I started checking around and noticing and asking people, do you like to listen to podcasts, or would you rather read a blog? And in my little poll, she was right. More people liked podcasts. So I thought, well, I really should consider this. And of course, starting a podcast is no simple feat. There's quite a lot involved with it, but she walked me through it. And once I got going, I kind of liked it. I have a small following, but a following anyway. And I think it's helping my business too.
Yeah, I think they're fun. I mean, and I will say, I mean, my format is different, and you know, the things that I'm trying to do are different, but from my standpoint, the conversations that I get to have and the people that I get to meet and have these conversations are honestly like the most inspiring thing that I've done in my career. Like I absolutely love the people that I talk to. I want to go have coffee or a glass of wine with like everybody that I meet. There's, you know, I haven't had one person that I've gone, gosh, I wish I hadn't talked to them. Like not one at all. You know, I just would I would love to have a big party that I got to have, you know, the women that I have been able to have on my podcast in a room. I think like that would be,
that would be fun.
Most ideal thing I could possibly wish for. Like I just, absolutely. I absolutely love doing my podcast.
Yeah. Well, you're good at it.
I
think you're good at the format that you have.
Well, thank you. Cause I get to talk to people. So I'm much more comfortable than with just a microphone.
That's right. But you know, one thing I'm always thinking about when I do my podcast is when I was an engineer, when I was working as an engineer, and especially when I had young children, I never would have had time to sit and listen to an hour long podcast. And so my thought was, most women engineers are you know, quite busy. And mm-hmm. so let's keep it in small enough snippets, but make it impactful so they take something away. And so that's a lot of why I have kept the format that I have.
Yeah, I think it's a great format. Mm-hmm. I like it.
Thanks.
Let's talk about what you did previously for a job. So before you started your current coaching business, mm-hmm. or you called it something else. What did you call it?
I call myself a career strategist.
That's it. Yes. Okay. Yeah. So before you started your career strategy business, mm-hmm. What did you do for a job?
Well, I worked for more than 30 years for the Air Force Research Lab here in the Dayton area. I worked primarily in the area of manufacturing technology and materials. It's a lab, so it's research and development. And most of my work was in program management, project engineering, program management, team leadership, that kind of stuff. When I started there, I learned how to manage programs, and I was able to have the opportunity to work on programs that were pretty high visibility and pretty high dollar amount, including programs in microelectronics manufacturing. We had a couple programs in commercial military integration, which was also in electronics. I also managed a big program in metals called the Metals Affordability Initiative. And later I moved into additive manufacturing or 3D printing and did some manage some teams and programs there as well. It's an interesting place to work because you get the opportunity to work on these leading edge technologies, and it's research and development. So those technologies won't be implemented probably for 10 or 20 years in some cases, but they have actual applications, and it's just very rewarding to be able to interact with the people you get to interact with who are sometimes world-renowned experts in the area, and then develop these technologies that eventually get implemented on systems.
Well, and you and I, when we talked a couple of weeks ago, you had talked about how you were a civilian. So you were not in the military, but you were a civilian working for the military. Can you tell me how that works?
Well, a lot of people are unaware of this. Yeah, you can work for the government and the military as a civilian employee, which means you are an employee of, in this case, the Air Force, but you're not in the military. So that's as opposed to maybe a contractor that would be a civilian as well, but that would be a company that gets contracted to the government. In my case, I was actually paid by the Air Force. So that is a possible career path, and lots of people take it. But for some reason, it's not very well known outside these organizations.
So you weren't in the military, but did you have some of the, I'm going to say, kind of stigmas of being female in the military that I think also provides some of the challenges that, you know, we as like technical women also have? Did you kind of have like that double-edged sword too?
There is a difference between working in the military and being a civilian, but you are subjected to things like the hierarchy. And, you know, it's very rank based. Of course, the rules and regulations that go along with that organization are there as well. So I would say there's some government red tape that you have to deal with. And just the fact that it's a bureaucracy, a military bureaucracy and a government bureaucracy, those are the kinds of things that you have to deal with. One of the things that affected us a lot, I think, in our lab and in the development of the technologies we developed is that the lab leader, the commander, is military. And as such, that person rotates out every handful of years, 2 to 4 years usually. You know, having a new leader that frequently, you have to be able to change to whatever their goals and emphasis is. And I think that's one thing that's quite different than industry.
That seems like that would be remarkably challenging. but also at the same time, probably a remarkably good skill set to have of being mm-hmm. able to adapt to different leadership styles very quickly. Mm-hmm. Did you find it being more good or more bad, or just was?
From my perspective, it just took getting used to. There were a few levels between me and the commander, so there was some buffer there. And there are some leadership positions that stay a little bit more steady. The other thing I'll mention is that in the lab, at the time I was there anyway, there's about 10% of the employees who are military. It's mostly civilian. And
really?
Yeah. And then about 10% are military. And again, those 10% rotate in and out. And so that's something that you have to get used to as a team leader or a supervisor, you know, that if you have military on your team, they're not going to be there forever. So you have to manage around that. So yeah, there is a plus side though, too, because it brings in fresh blood, it brings in new ideas and gets people used to adapting to change. So in that sense, it's a good thing.
I was texting my brother-in-law because I totally forgot that he worked for the Air Force in Dayton. So I was texting him. I'm like, so how big was the lab? Would you know so-and-so? He's like, pretty much like a city. And it was 24 years ago. So I was like, okay, we'll go with the no then.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a big place.
But he was military. He was actually in the mm-hmm. Air Force. And mm-hmm. and he's actually like one of the reasons that I went into electrical engineering. He was the only electrical engineer that I knew when I was trying to decide what kind of engineering I wanted to go into, because I had changed from, I wanted to be an architect, and then I found out that was art.
Science. Yeah. That's so funny, because I was gonna say that when I started college, I started in architecture.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah. Okay, thinking
what
that
made,
that's
what made you change.
First of all, I didn't know what engineering was back then.
Me either. Yep.
Yeah. And so that to me was like the closest thing to be able to use my math and science and, you know, be in a profession. But I was the same way. It was a little too artsy for me. And I wanted something that was more math and science and less art.
My classes were go out and build something with sticks and stones and then sketch it, or go sketch buildings on campus. And I'm like, I can't even draw a stick person.
Yeah.
And I had wanted to be an architect from the time I was in third grade until I was a freshman in college. And then I was like, this is not what I had thought that it was.
Right.
And I still have this idea that I want to design my own house someday. So I'm kind of like,
oh, fun
playing with the idea of doing that for my retirement house. But I'm also like, if I haven't done it by now, it may never happen. So I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I found that there were a lot of students in that program that already knew a lot about design. And I came in without knowing anything about design. And so that was scary. And then also, I thought that the professors, the way that they graded your work was very subjective.
Because it's art.
Yeah. So that drove me nuts, you know. So eventually I moved into manufacturing technology and then got into engineering.
Well, okay. So let's talk about that. What were your influences and what were your interests and stuff as a kid that made you initially want to go into architecture and then made you want to go into engineering?
Well, I was always good at math and science, and I liked those classes better than any other classes. Mm-hmm. I always had good grades all around, but those classes just, you know, I liked the structure and the organization and the, you know, how you had a problem and you came up with an answer. You know, I am very organized and structured. That's where I'm comfortable.
Yep. Get that.
So the other influences I would say is my parents ran a lumberyard, a home center business for 25 years. And I knew a little bit about hardware. I knew about building materials and that sort of thing. And then my oldest sister went into architecture, and she is an architect.
No. So she stayed.
She stayed. Yep. That's what she wanted to do. And so, you know, that was kind of my world. That's what I knew. And
How much older was she than you?
She's 6 years older than me.
Okay. So was she an architect by the time you went to school to go into the School of Architecture?
Just about. I think she was working in a firm at that time, but she also went to grad school. So
then when you decided that architecture was not the place for you, and I went through the same thought process of like, I like math and science. So what's the next logical mm-hmm. thing to do? Engineering. But then I didn't know what an engineer did either, because there weren't classes for them. Now all of my kids, they had classes from the time they were in kindergarten that talked about engineering, which I think is fabulous, mm-hmm. but I had no idea. So how did you settle on materials engineering and applied science, manufacturing, technology, and industrial and systems engineering that you got your PhD in? So like, how did you mm-hmm. decide like what area of engineering to go into? Mm-hmm.
Well, I tell you, the kids now have so many more programs and so much better support. It's way different now. There weren't enough counselors back then that would tell women to go into engineering. My counselor never told me that.
Oh, I have a friend whose counselor told her not to go into engineering, that she should be a teacher.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that happens too a lot. I did my undergrad at Miami University here in Ohio. That was the architecture program that I went into. They have a pretty good architecture program. But I ended up wanting to stay there because I really liked the campus. I really liked the school. And at that time, they didn't have an engineering department. They had an applied science department. Mm. And I just happened to attend, because I knew I wanted to change my major. I attended this little session they had in one of the cafeterias, and people from different departments came in to talk to students who wanted to change their majors. And so I happened to talk to one of the instructors there. His name was Errol Gundler. I still remember that. The way he talked to me was just fabulous, because he said, "We have this program. You would be perfect for this program. Here's all the things that we do. Here's all the things that our graduates do. Why didn't you come over here?" You know, and no one had ever talked to me like that for a technical program like that. Mm-hmm. And he was the first person who said, "You belong here. You should come over here." I was very intrigued. I thought that that was my best option if I was going to stay at Miami University. And so I got into that program. It was a 4-year technology degree. There were very few women in it. I think there were 2 or 3 in my class. I stuck with it anyway. And I got that degree. And so at that time, I wasn't an engineer. I just had a technology degree. And I ended up working in microelectronics manufacturing as a supervisor afterwards, before I ended up at the base. And at the base, I was able to go back to school and get a master's degree in engineering, and then my PhD in engineering. So the base had this program in manufacturing technology, and that's where I started. It was a pretty good fit for me. And, you know, the Air Force works with a lot of companies who manufacture things for them. And it was intriguing to be able to work with these companies and help them develop their technologies and drive the cost down and incorporate new ideas and improvements. And that's what we did.
So what made you decide to continue on and pursue a PhD? Because I hear there are a lot of work.
Yes, ma'am. when I started at the base, I immediately started in a master's program, and I did that part-time. Took me a couple of years to get my master's, but I didn't go directly into a PhD program. In fact, I didn't think I would ever get my PhD. Instead, I worked as a program manager, and I had the opportunity to work on a couple of big programs. But then I sort of hit a dead end at one point. I didn't know what I wanted to do next. And a PhD was one of my options. And that's what I decided to do, because it is in a lab and they do encourage higher level degrees. And there was a program that I was able to get into called long-term full-time training, where the Air Force paid me to go to school. So I still got my salary. They paid for my schooling. I was able to take all my classes. They gave me the time, even after I was done with classes, they gave me the time to work on my dissertation. Because of that program is really why I decided to go get my PhD, because we had 2 kids at home, 2 young kids. It otherwise just would have been impossible time-wise to do that.
Okay. So you were working on your PhD, working full-time and had two kids?
I did not have to work full-time. My full-time job was going to school.
Okay. So you were was it almost like you're on sabbatical so that you are just going to school? You're not necessarily mm-hmm. working at the same. Okay.
For the time that I was going to classes. Yes.
Okay.
And so that, you know,
that does sound like it would be like not quite, that sounds a little bit better.
It's a big perk. It's a big perk. And I really think that otherwise, if I did not get into that program, I never would have got my PhD because it just was too much to handle at the time. I ended up going to Ohio State in the Industrial and Systems Engineering program. It just seemed to be the closest to what I was working on at the base and what my background was. And it allowed me to get my foot in the door for the 3D printing or the additive manufacturing technologies, or at that time the additive manufacturing wasn't even a phrase yet back then, but it was rapid prototyping. And that's what I did my dissertation on.
So how long ago was that?
Yeah. So that was in the early 2000s. It was just getting started. And I think when I got my degree was 2004. And so after that time, it was so slowly creeping along, making its way. And then I would say by the later part of that decade, people were starting to really push the technology and they were coming to the Air Force and saying, we want to use this technology. We want to make it work for your systems. And so we had to do a lot of work to make sure that the parts that were made with those processes were safe and reliable.
So were these parts that were like going like onto like planes or like, I'm not totally sure exactly what all the Air Force does. I know you guys build a whole lot of stuff so that's not necessarily planes.
Yeah. Well, in the lab, we didn't build parts. They don't build parts in the lab. They just do the research for the materials and the technologies that you can use for building them later.
Okay. So it would be like doing the research to understand the parts that the Air Force might then be using later on. Is that?
It's more like doing the research on the materials that could be processed using 3D printing and end up with the quality needed for parts that are going to fly.
Okay.
And it took a long time to get to that point because we knew the casting technologies and the forging technologies and the machining technologies, we knew those inside out and upside down pretty well and knew the quality and what they're capable of, but we didn't know anything about additive manufacturing. And so they had to kind of start from square one and develop all the data, collect all the data and develop all the, what they know about it now.
So was that, that sounds like a really interesting area to be working in. Did you mm-hmm. find that to be a super interesting area to work in?
Yeah, it was. I think the most interesting part of it is that it was a new technology. I mean, new technologies like that don't come around that often. It was a little bit scary because people were very eager to use them. And were, you know, a lot of people were pushing the technologies before there was enough safety data about them. Mm-hmm. But it was also exciting because it's new and you could see what the capabilities were. And even now, it's still headed in that direction.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing the stuff that they can make. Like I still think it's mind-boggling. Buildings, and I think I've even heard body parts and stuff like that. Like it seems so crazy to me that. Yeah. You know, that could be manufactured.
As you know, a lot of the things that go into an airplane have to be very stringently designed so that they don't break apart in the air.
I'm all for that.
Yeah, most of us are. And so there are certain pieces that will probably never be built using additive technologies, but there are plenty of applications that are appropriate for them. So
what are you most proud of in your career?
I look at my career overall and I'm just amazed that I even went into this field. You know, no one in my family was an engineer, no one in my immediate family until my younger sister. I didn't know anything about it, yet I was able to get into it and be successful at it. So I think I'm really proud of that. And there's a lot more that I wish I had done. I wish I'd gone farther and done, you know, took more opportunities. But all in all, I think it's pretty cool what I did. I'm also very proud of the fact that I started this business, my new business. That's not something that occurred to me until a few years before I retired. And that was also a steep learning curve. So I'm proud of that too.
Looking through, you know, at least like your career through LinkedIn and stuff is so impressive. And I also think that starting a business is something that is super admirable. And I think it's probably also, I'm going to guess, maybe a little bit scary because you're kind of like starting something new on your own and stuff. So I'm sure there's kind of like a fear component maybe.
Oh yeah. Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I worked with a coach, Rhonda Hess. She's excellent. And that made all the difference. But I look at where I was before I started launching her engineering career and where I am now. And it's just like, wow, so much brand new stuff that I had to learn. And I remember looking at it from the other end and thinking, oh, this is such a mountain I have to climb. I don't know if it's going to work. But as they say, how do you eat an elephant, right? One spoonful at a time. And that's how it was. And then after you get to the end, it's like, wow, I actually did it and still have more to do. It's a good feeling to be where I am now.
What kinds of things do you still want to do?
In my business?
Yeah. Well, or in general?
Well, I'm at the point in my business where I am wanting to grow it. So it's all set up. I got most of my basic services in place. So now it's a matter of gaining new clients and getting more experience, putting myself out there and doing more of the same to help these women. I have a lot of ideas of what I want to do in general. Nothing that I'm super focused on right now because I'm still like working on this baby. Maybe someday I'll write a book. Maybe someday I will do a similar kind of business for a different client. I'm thinking of, rather than just doing coaching, kind of expanding that, doing other kinds of consulting as well.
Sounds like you have a lot of good things up your sleeve.
I always have something on my list, as my husband would say.
Yeah, the list never seems to go down. I don't know. Mine doesn't either. What is the best advice that you have given or been given?
Some really good advice that I've been given lately that 10 years ago probably was given to me too, but I didn't listen to it. And that is, stop working so hard to make things happen and allow things to come. Allow things to come to you. Allow ideas to come to you. Allow things to unfold. That's my word of the year, by the way, unfold. And I have noticed, so, you know, I feel like I'm finally in a place in my life where I can practice this. And so I've tried that. Let's throttle back on how hard you're working and make it easier, make it more enjoyable. And when you do that, things happen. Things come to you. Ideas come more easily. You end up working more in the flow and you're more productive. So I think that is an awesome piece of advice. And I am starting to give that to my clients as well.
Okay. That's really interesting because now I feel like you may have just given me that advice specifically for me because it was either, I don't know, earlier today, yesterday, the day before, I don't know, somewhere in like very recent that I heard something very, very similar. And I always think like, if you keep hearing the same message, something in the universe is trying to tell you something. And so how have you been able to put that into practice? Like, so from a standpoint of like, how do you like realistically put that into practice? Do you have any advice on that?
Well, I can give you two examples. One that I actually did when I was still working at the lab, the person who had given me that advice wasn't in so many words, but basically he was telling me, you're working too hard. You know, stop staying late, just stop working and go home, right? I had to be ready to actually implement this because I'm always thinking, well, I got 5 minutes, so that means I can do three more things, right? But one day I just decided I was going to take his advice and I stopped working about 4:45. 5 o'clock was my nominal go home time, though I rarely made it out in time. But I stopped working at 4:45 and I cleaned up my desk and I took a little sticky and I wrote down a couple of things that I was going to do when I came in the morning. And by 5 o'clock, I was out the door. And I remember walking to my car and thinking, wow, this really feels great. I'm walking to my car. It's 5 o'clock. And I was thinking that the next day I was going to feel swamped because I didn't stay late and finish whatever it was I was working on. But I came home and I had a few minutes extra to prepare dinner. And I didn't feel so rushed. And then when I went back to work the next day, I didn't really have that feeling of, oh, I got all this work to do that I didn't do yesterday. It wasn't like that at all. It was just like, okay, here's a new day. Let's start again and do those three things on your sticky or whatever. And you just have to do it and feel what it feels like. It just takes away that gotta attitude and calms you a little bit, takes a little stress out. And there's always more work to do. There's always more work to do. So no matter how many hours you work, you're never going to get it all done. So you may as well just go home on time.
There is no finish line. That's kind of what I'm learning. Like the finish line just keeps moving.
That's right. And the other example, what has been recently, you know, after I got my business set up, I had a list of things that I wanted to do to try to attract more clients, right? Mm-hmm. And every day I was working really hard on these things, and whether it's writing an article or talking to so-and-so and then that message came to me that maybe you shouldn't try so hard, right? That what you were saying earlier, you start seeing that message more because you're ready to hear it. I throttled it back a little bit. And I said, you know, I'm just going to work so many hours and let the rest come to me. And in that particular case, I had a client contact me that very week. And
oh, interesting.
Yeah. And I'm just like, oh, well, there must be something to this, you know? So I think it's a great piece of advice.
Yeah, I think it is too. So I'm going to figure out how that is meant to apply to me, because now you're making me think that that's meant to apply to me. So
it could work.
I sure hope so. Well, Mary, I'm so glad that you reached out and that I got the chance to talk to you. This has been absolutely delightful. And I have really just enjoyed our conversation and getting the chance to talk to you and share your story and your new venture. And I wish you all the best with building it and growing it, and don't work so hard. It'll just come.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, thanks so much for having me. I've enjoyed the conversation too. And I look forward to hearing it.
Well, thanks. And I will have information on your business and your podcast and everything like that in the show notes. So, people can check that out. And
okay. Awesome.
I hope that we can keep in touch. This has been a lot of fun.
All right. Thanks, Kathy.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Ordinarily Extraordinary Conversations with Women in STEM. If you enjoyed this podcast, please like it, share it, and follow it to receive more episodes every week. And please join me for future episodes. Thank you.